In part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Travis Stansel, and Henry Frain is at the controls. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about pensions, something that has been in the news lately for a number of reasons. There have been a number of high-profile bankruptcies and people losing their 401k money, obviously. And we heard news this morning about Ken Lay being indicted, the former CEO of Enron, and one of the big stories in that larger story. The second point that has been in the news, pension funding has been in crisis in corporate America over the past year. And number three, some of the funding issues facing public pensions in Illinois in terms of the state funding and the longevity of the viability of those funds. We'll talk about some of those overarching issues with Jeffrey Brown. He's professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. And he's good enough to come here and sort of give us an overview. This will not be a show in which we can answer personal financial planning kinds of questions. That's a show we save for David Sinnoh or Kevin Waspy on the third Friday of the month. However, we're going to be talking about the sort of large-scale issues in the pension. I don't want to say crisis, but maybe that's a, you know, I won't put that word in Jeffrey Brown's mouth, but we'll talk about some of the situations that face people as they plan for retirement, some of the large-scale issues in the pension system in the United States. Jeffrey Brown is assistant professor in the Department of Finance at the University of Illinois here at Champaign-Urbana. Prior to coming here, he was an assistant professor of public policy at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government, and he also has served as a senior economist at the White House Council of Economic Advisors, where he focused primarily on Social Security, pension reform, and terrorism risk insurance. He has a BA in economics and political science from Miami University, a master's in public policy at Harvard University Kennedy School of Government, and a PhD in economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And we're glad to have him with us during this hour. If you have questions, you can join us. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Jeffrey Brown, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. We just heard news about this sort of emblematic symbol of the corporate scandals that occurred in which a lot of people lost their 401ks, et cetera, Ken Lay being indicted. Obviously, that's been one of the higher profile issues in the area of pensions, but there are other issues as well that we should probably talk about. So there's a whole bunch of things. Where should we start? I guess one of the things I wanted to ask you to talk about is the distinction between some of the private and public pension systems and what are some of the key issues in each of those areas.
Sure. I think it'd be useful just to start by putting all this into context, which is that private pensions over the last century or so have increased in importance as an income source for elderly Americans. And today, sort of in aggregate, about one out of every $5 that flows as income to retirees comes from private pensions. This is expected to grow as we go forward, particularly when one takes into account the fiscal pressures facing Social Security and so forth. And indeed, some people estimate that, you know, just 401k plans alone, which we'll talk about in a bit more detail soon, may rival Social Security in the next couple decades in terms of their importance to individuals. The pensions have been in the news a lot in recent years. It all sort of began with the Enron bankruptcy and the fact that it was a pension crisis, at least for the individuals affected in that case. And more recently, some of the rather severe pension funding problems that have arisen for private corporate plans due largely to the decline in the stock market, changes in interest rates, and so forth. As you mentioned, and we can talk about this, the problems that have faced the private sector in terms of their pension funding have not been unique to private corporations, but many state plans, such as the State University Retirement System and other public pension plans here in Illinois, have also been affected by that. I think it'd probably be useful to start with just a distinction between sort of two basic types of plans that are out there. For people that may or may not be familiar, I should note at first, the pension area is a very complex legal and actuarial and accounting environment, and therefore it can often be a rather confusing area to get into. I think it's important to just simplify and take into account the fact that there are really just two types of pension plans out there. There are what are traditionally called defined benefit or DB plans. These are the type of plan that were predominant a few decades ago. These are the type of plan where you go to work for an employer and they say, hey, you work for us for 30 years and at retirement we'll give you income every month that's equal to, say, 60% of your salary. Those have over the last few decades been replaced by and large with what are called defined contribution or DC plans, which are like 401ks where instead of guaranteeing you a benefit at retirement, a company just says, we're going to put some money into your account, and there are some pluses and minuses along with that. That's probably been the single most important trend in the pension area over the last couple decades, and I think it's important to note that.
The DB plan being the least sort of intensive involvement on the part of the individual, I would imagine. The DC plan would involve making decisions about what you do with that money and therefore sort of bearing more responsibility for making it grow, hopefully, over the long term. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. So in a traditional defined benefit plan, an employee working for a company essentially knew that their benefit was going to be based on how long they worked for that company, as mm-hmm. well as a formula that mm-hmm. that company had in place. With a defined contribution plan, they're making the company and you maybe making contributions to that plan. And then you have both the opportunity as well as sort of the risk associated with being able to make your own investment choices. So, for example, in a corporate defined benefit plan, if the stock market crashes, the individual pensioner, by and large, is protected from that. It is the shareholders of the company that are going to have to come up with the money, essentially, to make good on that pension promise, or in some cases, the federal government through a guarantee corporation that is set up. With a defined contribution plan, if the stock market does extremely well or extremely poorly, it's the individual that directly bears both the upside and the downside of that. There are some other differences as well in terms of how the income is paid out and so forth, but that's really the most important distinction.
We have a caller to get to, and I promise I will include them in just a minute, but just a quick follow-up on that. You noted that over the past 25 years, there's been a dramatic shift away from the defined benefit pension plans and toward the defined contribution plans. Why is that? What's driving that?
Well, there's a number of reasons for it. It's useful to, I won't go into a long history of pensions, but it's useful to go back a little bit. The defined benefit plans really sort of took off back in the post-World War II period and grew very rapidly. And what was happening is back in those early days, in the 50s and the 1960s, companies could make promises to employees to pay future income, but they were under no requirement to actually set aside assets today to meet those future obligations. So to some extent, the pension income was only as that promise was sort of only as good as the financial solvency of that company. If that company wasn't going to be there when you retired, you weren't going to get your pension. And in fact, there were some high-profile corporate bankruptcies, you know, four decades ago, such as Studebaker in Indiana and so forth, where a lot of people lost a lot of money. So in the early 1970s, Congress passed a sort of big landmark piece of legislation that pension experts all refer to as ERISA, was the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, and it imposed a number of new regulations on defined benefit plans. There is some belief that at least part of the shift away from defined benefit to defined contribution plans is simply because they're administratively much more difficult to administer and more expensive because things like 401k plans are by and large not covered by the same regulations. There's also been arguably an increase in labor force mobility, one of the benefits to employees of the defined contribution type plans is that they're more mobile. And so when you leave an employer, you know, you can just take that account with you, roll it over into a new plan or what have you. And it tends to be more generous for people that are switching between jobs. There are other reasons as well, but I'd say those are probably the more important ones.
Okay. We have a caller waiting. Why don't we include them in our conversation? That's someone in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I recently, or a while ago, heard that the governor wanted to combine all the pension plans in the state into one. And so I just think if that happens, we that have belong to sewers, we can just kiss our pensions goodbye. And I just want to know what you know about that.
Sure. There have been proposals to combine the state university retirement system with the other public pension plans in Illinois. The motivation behind that, as I understand it, is primarily an attempt to reduce administrative overhead and so forth. I'm actually somewhat skeptical of whether those cost savings would be very substantial or not. And certainly people in the CSRS system have not been in favor of that. As far as whether that would be the end of your pension, there's something that's very interesting.
I can hear music.
What?
The music is drowning out your voice.
Maybe.
Oh, there it is. That's better.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Sorry about that. What's happening in the state of Illinois, which is very sort of unique, is that there is actually a constitutional, what's called the impairment clause in the Illinois state constitution that essentially states that once a person starts working, say, for the University of Illinois, the legislature is not allowed to change their benefit promise. They're not allowed to impair their benefit in any way. So the good news for the individual pensioners or individual participants is that even if such a plan were to go through, the benefits that you've earned up to this point and so forth can't in any way be touched. That would actually be violating the Constitution of the state. I don't know if this proposal is actually going to go anywhere. I don't follow the politics of it on a day-to-day basis, but my understanding is it was largely an attempt to try to get some administrative efficiencies, which I doubt will be very large.
So your guess is that's not going to happen? Not going to combine them.
I don't really have any inside information on whether it will or will not happen, but I think you can at least rest assured that if it did, that your benefits would be protected.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. And I do know that that was a proposal floated by the governor over the past year, but that it was not greeted warmly in the State House, and
that's
that
correct.
At least for this year, it is off the table. And, of course, who knows what's going to happen in the future. But I do remember that at least. We have another caller in Champaign County on line number two next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning.
You're playing your latest recording in the background, are you? Is that what's on?
No.
Okay. I was hoping you would. Anyway, survey of the reasons why this change has happened, you didn't seem to emphasize the fact that corporations are basically trying to minimize their the expense that they're, you know, that they're cutting back on this. Seems like that's the most thing. And I wonder if anybody's looked at that in aggregate, how much from their point of view, they've saved. And then also there's the other dimension, which is there have been some pretty flagrant cases of pretty much thievery at that level of corporations pretty much taking the pension fund and using it in some ways. It's hard maybe to aggregate that because it's happened in a variety of ways through a variety of financial shenanigans, so you can't really say they outright stole it, but they used it in different ways. So what do you have on that?
If there's something that I neglected in terms of the trends, I'd say the more important one is the fact that over the last several decades there have been a number of what I would call sectoral shifts in employment, meaning that as some of the traditional industries have declined, and those were some of the industries that had defined benefit plans, they've sort of gone out of existence, and a lot of the newer companies that have come into existence have tended to rely more on defined contribution plans. So a lot of the shift that we have seen has not even been individual companies dropping a defined benefit plan and taking up a defined contribution plan, but rather there are different companies now than there were 20 or 30 years ago. In terms of companies doing this sort of thing for the cost saving, there's really no evidence to suggest that aggregate contributions to pensions have declined. There are certainly, one can find individual examples of companies that have cut back on the generosity of their pensions and so forth. But it's important to keep in mind that in a competitive market, they're somewhat constrained in their ability to do that because pensions are part of a compensation package. And if they, you know, don't have an overall compensation package, which is competitive with the rest of their industry, they're not going to be able to attract and retain workers and so forth, which is largely one of the motivations for having a pension in the first place. So I think there are certainly instances of that, but I don't think that's an overarching trend. As far as the issue of thievery, I'm not sure what specific examples you have in mind. It was certainly the case that back, say, in the 1980s, there were cases where what some people refer to as corporate raiders or takeovers and so forth would come in and they would use the proceeds of an overfunded pension plan and then essentially terminate the plan and use that money elsewhere. But Congress in the 1980s passed a number of laws to make that a much more expensive thing to do and by and large shut down that type of activity. The cases we've seen more recently in terms of things like Enron and so forth were not really problems with the pensions themselves, except insofar as what was happening is companies had a very high fraction, like Enron, of their assets invested in their own company stock. And so when there were potentially illegal activities going on in the rest of the company that then led to dramatic stock price declines, that certainly had an effect on those pensioners. But I don't know of any specific examples of people actually sort of stealing money from the pension funds and so forth.
Well, in the case of Enron and some of the other corporations that have been in the spotlight recently for, you know, cooking the books essentially and making it look like they were making money when they were actually losing it, a lot of the damage to pensions seemed to be from people who had invested, including, you know, municipal funds and you know, unions and other large organizations that pooled, you know, money and then invested it in the long-term hope that that would return, you know, retirement dividends in the long run, and that money simply evaporated.
Yeah, in particular, the issue is that in plans like 401k plans and other defined contribution plans, there are no restrictions against how much of those assets can be held in the stock of the company that is sponsoring the plan. So, for example, Enron was not alone. If you look as of, I think this data is about a year and a half old, but there are all sorts of companies like Procter & Gamble, Abbott Labs, Pfizer, Anheuser-Busch, others who have on the order of 80 to 90% of their pension plan assets are invested in company stock. Now, in some cases, this is due to the fact that the company is providing a match in order to get people to participate in the plan. So they say to you, you know, if you contribute 6% of your salary, we'll match it and give you sort of 3% more, and we're going to put that match in the company stock. But a lot of it's also driven by the fact that the individual employee chooses to put some of their money in that company stock. And so what happened with these high-profile bankruptcies like Enron, Global Crossing, Polaroid, and others, she had these companies where 20 to 40% of the 401k plan was held in the company stock, mm-hmm. and the company stock, you know, dropped by 99% mm-hmm. over a matter of months. And so there were individual retirees that essentially lost everything. Mm-hmm. There are protections against that in defined benefit plans because defined benefit plans are allowed to have at most 10% of the assets in company securities.
So really the problem there is too many people having too much of their own retirement investments in the company they work for.
That's right. And you know, if you talk to any sort of financial planner, financial economist, so forth, I know this is not a financial advice show, but I think we would all sort of agree that when you work for a company and therefore your earnings potential and so forth is sort of tied up in the in that one company, you don't also want to tie up your entire retirement income in the fortunes of that one company either. For that matter, you don't want to do it in any one company. I mean, we want to have diversification. Right. You don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. You want to have a well-diversified portfolio. So even if you worked here at the university and you put 80% of your money in Coca-Cola stock, I would tell you that's a bad idea. That's a particularly bad idea if you're a Coca-Cola employee, because then you run into these situations where at the same time that you lose your job, you also see your pension assets dry up. And so there clearly are too many people holding undiversified pension portfolios out there. And that is an issue that really came to fore about 3 years ago with the Enron issue and other bankruptcies at the time.
Do we have a sense of the overall amount that that pension funds have lost? You know, I know it was state university retirement systems or state employee retirement systems invested in companies like Enron. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
But a lot of these public retirement systems were counting on these corporate returns that ended up not panning out, obviously, in the case of Enron, Global Crossing, a few others. Do we have a sense of the overall dollar amount or the amount of damage that was done by these large failures?
I could probably back out a ballpark estimate, although I don't know if I can do it off the top of my head. We do know that pension plans in the U.S. hold several $1 trillion worth of assets in the U.S. Mm-hmm. equity markets, and for that matter, global equity markets as well. And we know that from the market's peak until sort of its most recent trough, stock prices had fallen by 20-25%. So we're talking, trillions of dollars that were lost. The market has certainly rebounded since then. I think we're somewhere between 10-15% below the market's peak. Mm-hmm. That is sort of the statistic that matters, because most pension plans, particularly publicly managed pension plans like CSRS and other state plans, are very well diversified. Mm-hmm. So the failure of one individual company like Enron is actually not going to have a substantial effect on their overall portfolio. The failure of lots of companies, which then led to, the NASDAQ falling from 5,000 down to well under 2,000, that can have a very substantial effect. And in fact, we've seen that. So here in the state of Illinois, as of about a year ago, this picture has changed somewhat, although it's still not very attractive. As of June 30th of last year, the state university retirement system had just under $10 billion in assets, but their liabilities were $18 billion. Mm-hmm. So they only had the assets to cover about 50-55%. Of their liabilities. And we saw lots of corporations in similar situations, such that in January of this year, it was estimated that the shortfall by corporate America in terms of their pension obligations was on the order of $325 billion. It takes an awful lot of corporate earnings to come up with that kind of money to fill in the gap. In both of these cases, I mean, this was in part driven by the stock market decline. It was also in part driven by the fact that interest rates were very low, and therefore the way they do their calculation of their liabilities, it caused their liabilities to increase at the exact same time their assets were declining.
We have another call to talk with. Let me just briefly introduce our guest again. Jeffrey Brown is professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about pensions, some of the large issues that have affected both public and private pensions over the past few years, and we invite your calls. This is not a personal finance kind of show. That's something we do once a month with David Sinnoh or Kevin Waspy, but we're talking about the large-scale issues involving pensions. If you have questions, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Next caller, line number one, I think in Champaign. Good morning.
Urbana.
Urbana, thank you.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering about the ability of potential pensioners to actually review the performance of fund administrators. Personally, long ago, I'd met a few fellow employees, or actually just a couple, who were on an employee review board when it came to the pension. And over the years, I've come to realize that I rather doubt if these people were qualified really in any kind of way at all to review the key financial transactions engaged upon by the fund administrators. I don't know what the situation is at the U of I, but I imagine there's a similar situation. Is that correct, where there are employees on some sort of review board or something like that?
Yeah, there is a board for the State University Retirement System, and in fact, I believe it's a 7-member board, although I could be wrong about that. For example, there's a University of Illinois economics professor who is a member of that board. There are some people from outside the system as well. And they are charged with a legal fiduciary responsibility to manage that plan in the best interest of the participants and the pensioners. And they are supported by, you know, a CSRS professional staff of lawyers and investment specialists and so forth. And that is their sort of legal obligation and legal role to oversee that. And all pension plans have that type of an arrangement, and they're all regulated by the Department of Labor. This is not to say, though, that all of them do a good job. We certainly see examples where the Department of Labor has to come in and really shake up pension plans and impose penalties and so forth. And it certainly is it is never a bad idea for employees to ask lots of questions and probe and sort of put the pressure on folks to be as transparent as possible about those types of, you know, the transactions, the performance, and so forth. There are all sorts of legal requirements for these plans to make this type of data available, to know what the investment performance is, what the fees are that are being paid to investment managers, and so forth. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal just yesterday about Elliot Spitzer, the Attorney General in New York, is now going to start looking at some 401k plan financial arrangements with various providers and fund managers to see if there were sort of, I don't want to use, this is a loaded term, but to see if there were sort of kickbacks back and forth between them. And so this type of thing does go on, and it is worth tracking.
Well, I don't find the fact that you're going to the fund administrators themselves for key information to be very persuasive as to the efficacy of that kind of review board. I mean, just because CSRS says this or that, I don't think is rises to any kind of level of confidence in my eyes anyway.
Well, but sure. I would just note, I should have said this earlier, there are also outside audits of most of these plans typically done by either accounting firms or actuarial consulting firms that will come in and actually have to sign off and verify on those calculations. And they certainly have a professional standard and a reputation uphold. And so that's meant to be a check on the system.
You mean a reputation I would say of late at least, their reputation has been on the downside rather than the upside. But let me ask you some general questions.
Sure.
Compared to mutual funds of similar amounts, how are these pension funds doing? And if they're doing better, why is that? And I understand that if you look at the pension funds and if you look at their performance in general, you know, if you look at them, kind of compare them to mutual funds, of which there's been a lot of shenanigans going on lately too.
That's right.
That their performance is not that good, and that the management fees, which you mentioned, are really actually quite high. I understand that, for example, banks in Chicago, and I believe our funds are have a relationship with banks in Chicago. Look upon, you know, having this account as a huge plum, and that they can really milk it for huge management fees. So, can you talk a little bit about that?
I can say a bit about that, though maybe not to the level of detail that you're looking for. As far as the general question about comparing overall pension fund performance to mutual funds, on a pre-expense basis, they tend to be very similar. I mean, it's hard. One has to compare apples to apples because naturally if you're comparing mutual funds in a high growth sector to a diversified pension fund or something, that's not really a fair risk-adjusted comparison. But taken as a whole, they almost have to do roughly equally well on a pre-expense basis simply because mutual funds taken in aggregate and pension funds taken in aggregate are both essentially holding a representation of the overall equity markets. And so there's only so far that in aggregate they're going to deviate from that. The big, big, big issue in all of this and that people fail to people often fail to appreciate the magnitude is how important expense ratios are in all of this. This is true when you're looking at pensions. This is true when you're looking at mutual funds and so forth. You may look at expenses and see that, it's only, a half of a percentage point per year. But the way that compounds and accumulates over time, a half a percentage point difference in annual administrative costs can actually lead to, a 10% difference in how much retirement income you have at the end of 30 years. Now, many times, pensions actually have an advantage here in that if you invest in, say, Vanguard S&P 500 fund through a 401k plan, you'll actually get a lower expense ratio than you would if you were to invest in that same Vanguard fund as an individual. And therefore, there are some advantages to that. In the state university retirement system, for those types of investments, they have rather low expenses. Where the expenses start getting very high is when pension funds, and many of them do this, put aside a small part of their portfolio into sort of hedge funds and venture capital funds and things like that that are really going out there. And they're a much more sort of labor-intensive activity. And so they may be charging as high as, a couple of percent of assets. And, it's a legitimate question as to whether that couple of percent of assets in terms of expenses is really being offset by higher returns. I don't know the evidence on that, but the fact that they continue to do it suggests that at least the administrators think it's a good idea.
Hope it gets to the caller's question. We have another caller waiting patiently, and we'll go on to them. This is someone in Mattoon on line number 2. Good morning.
Yes, sir. The traditional pension, the company which insures the traditional pension plans, which is called the PBGC, or the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, they themselves are in deep debt and trouble and have racked up an $11.2 billion deficit this year, this financial year. Are they going to survive?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mentioned earlier that back in 1974, there was this piece of legislation called ERISA, and one of the things that did was establish the PBGC, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. And up until the last year or so, the PBGC had always done quite well. What it basically does is any defined benefit plan has to pay essentially insurance premiums to them each year. Mm-hmm. And they in turn impose, there are certain requirements imposed on that firm. But if that company were to go bankrupt and if the assets of the plan are not sufficient to cover the benefits for employees, the PBG will step in and essentially take that over and make those payments. Over the last, say, 3, 4, 5 years, they've had sort of a record number of very expensive bankruptcies, a lot of steel companies and airline companies that have gone bankrupt and have been dumping, in some cases, individual companies dumping $1 billion or $2 billion worth of unfunded liabilities on the PBGC. My sense is that what will happen here is that Congress is going, I mean, this is a government organization, so Congress is going to fund that. So the problem is not so much that the people whose pensions are guaranteed by the PBGC aren't going to get payment. It's a problem for the taxpayer. We've got, severe problems facing the PBGC at the same time that we're, facing problems with Social Security and the broader budget. What this brings to mind, though, is a problem at the PBGC, and this is somewhat more technical than is probably appropriate for this show, but the issue is that private companies are required to maintain assets that are leased that are equal to at least 90% of their liabilities. And we've got a lot of companies today that are well below that, and we ought to be thinking about ways of structuring the premium payments and so forth to provide the proper incentives to keep these plans funded. And unfortunately, instead, what we've done this year is pass some legislation that has essentially let the steel companies and the airlines off the hook, not completely, but we've substantially lessened the short-term burden on them, but have probably placed increased pressure on the PBGC in the coming years. And there's an important policy question that needs to be addressed there.
Yes, sir. I see. I am a United Airlines pensioner, and I have 30 years in there. And United Airlines today is very iffy that they will survive.
That's
why I'm sort of shaking here. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks
You're
for
welcome.
The call. So let me clarify that a little bit. So in the case of United Airlines, say if United Airlines does go bankrupt, and what happens? Essentially, the law kicks in, and the pensions are supposed to be guaranteed, but at what level?
Up to a point. And I believe that point is up around something like $40,000 to $50,000 a year in pension mm-hmm. income. People who are expecting pensions in that range or below are relatively held harmless, that they will just start receiving their pension income from the PBGC rather than from their employer. The people that really lose from this are people who are expecting higher pension benefits. So, for example, the pilots at United Airlines, which traditionally pilots are a highly compensated occupation, if their plan goes into bankruptcy and is taken over by the PBGC, they will not get an amount that is equal to what they're expecting. And so they will suffer a significant shortfall from that. Just to give you an idea, Pan Am went bankrupt a couple of years ago and left an $800 million liability on the taxpayer. Eastern Airlines, Transworld Air, these are all airline companies that have gone bankrupt with at least a $500 million of unfunded liabilities that the taxpayer is now providing. And part of what makes this bad is that and sometimes the situation is worse than it appears. So for example, when U.S. Air had a plan for its pilots, according to the calculations, they were 94% funded. But when they actually terminated the plan, they only had assets equal to about a third of its liability. And this just had to do with some sort of goofy ways that they did the accounting. Nothing was illegal. It's just there are a number of different ways to do this type of liability accounting. And that's a real problem and is something that needs to be addressed.
So in the case of the large-scale picture in terms of the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation, it doesn't have the assets that it needs to cover all these failures. Is it because of the number of failures? Is that the primary factor? Also, interest rates, the economy in general, obviously those things affect the bankruptcy rate, but...
Yeah, it has really been an unprecedented number of high, very expensive bankruptcies. Let's put it this way. Since 1974, when the PBGC was first put into place, they've had a total of about $16 billion in claims. Okay, these are plans that have shut down, and if you just add it all up, it's about $16 billion. Well, in the last just couple of years, we've had almost $4 billion claim from Bethlehem Steel. So that accounts alone for 25% of the claims they've ever had. At almost the same time, there's a $2 billion claim by LTV Steel. So we've really just seen in the last, since say around 2001, we've seen the lion's share of all the expensive bankruptcies have happened. And they've all been piled on the PBGC at once. And clearly the premiums that they were charging were not high enough. So Congress will essentially has to step up to the plate and provide the resources for this. And so, as I mentioned, except for the highly compensated employees, most employees don't have too much to worry about. But the taxpayers do. So,
okay. We have just about 12 minutes left in this hour, Focus 580. We're talking with Jeffrey Brown, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois, and we're talking about pension issues. If you have questions for us in the time remaining, you can call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. I was just kind of curious about the impact all this has had on people's confidence in the pension system. There has been increasing criticism of 401k plan, that scenario. And, you know, what can you say about, you know, we encourage people to, you know, plan for their retirement and to make the proper investments and to get active in the case of these DC plans, more active in making choices that are going to benefit them in the long term. On the other hand, you know, all these hits have an effect on people's confidence in being able to make those plans.
Yeah, and there are some retirement confidence surveys that are done annually, and without question, individual confidence levels about their own retirement planning suffered a pretty severe hit over the last few years. I think it is important to step back and recognize that, broadly speaking, it looks like we're heading in a direction where individuals are going to be taking on more responsibility for planning for their own retirement. We see this shift from defined benefit to defined contribution plans and pensions. We see discussion of personal accounts and Social Security and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so all this is going to put more responsibility on the individual to make their investment decisions and so forth. And this really, I think, calls for a real need for, you know, just education and convincing people of the desirability of diversification and thinking about issues of you know, one issue that we haven't really touched on, but which is a difference between these types of pension plans, is that most of the discussion and focus is on people accumulating assets so that they have a nice nest egg when they retire. Mm-hmm. There's a lot less attention paid to how you're going to make that money last for the rest of your life once you do retire. Mm-hmm. And there are these products out there called life annuities, which sort of provide some insurance against outliving your income. And defined benefit plans have played that role traditionally. Most 401k plans don't offer such an option, and it's important to think both at the level of public policy as well as at the level of the individual as to how to prepare for that going forward.
A couple callers. So we'll get next to someone in Indiana on line number 4. Good morning.
Morning. If it is a problem, what can happen when one moves, especially now in our economic situation, one moves from job to job, and carrying the 401k plan along with you. Besides, you know, clerical errors that can be made, what sort of things should one look out for?
One of the great advantages of 401k plans is their portability. The fact that when you leave a job, as long as you have been there long enough to be vested in the employer contributions, you can take the whole thing with you. And typically, you're allowed to roll that over into the new 401k, or you can put it into an IRA, an individual retirement account. I think as long as you're doing that, there's actually not too much to concern yourself with. This is a fairly standard transaction now. The bigger problem from a policy point of view, and this from your question, it doesn't sound like this applies to you, is that oftentimes people will work for a few years for a company and they will leave that job and they may have a couple thousand dollars in their account and then they just pull that money out. And when they pull that money out, they have to pay a tax penalty, they have to pay income tax, that money's gone, and they might not realize that couple of thousand bucks that they now get to consume today is going to lower their retirement wealth by tens of thousands of dollars because of the tax differences and the compounding and so forth. So the most important thing is just to continue to keep that money in a tax-deferred form, not to pull that out unless you absolutely have to. But if you're doing that, I don't actually see that there's too much to concern oneself with when switching jobs.
Okay. We have an Urbana caller next on line number 1. Good morning.
Yeah, I called earlier, but I just wanted to make a quick comment and ask another question.
Okay.
And that is, you mentioned the composition of our CSRS review board, you mentioned that there was an economist there, and I don't think that's the equivalent of having, you know, like a finance expert or a pension specialist. An economist would not particularly be any better at reviewing what's going on, I don't think, than anybody else, but that's just my opinion. I wanted to ask you, there's been written lately a lot about the problems in Europe, that they are actually ahead of us when it comes to the kind of problems with pensions and all that we're probably going to experience. And like, for example, Chirac and Schroeder are having a whole lot of problems when they're trying to cut back benefits, and I'm just curious as to whether or not you people have any kind of, you know, are seeing, you know, what's likely to happen here over there in Europe. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, actually, a lot of the discussion of what's going on with the European pension plans is really a discussion about their public pension plans and therefore sort of analogous to our Social Security system. A fundamental difference between Social Security here or their public pension systems over there, the difference between those and the type of corporate plans we're talking about here is that those public plans, by and large, tend to not be funded at all, but rather paid for on what we call a pay-as-you-go basis. So the tax revenue that's being paid into the system today is immediately being paid out to current beneficiaries, and there really are no assets being built up. And the difficulty with that type of system is that when the demographics shift on you and you have a lot more old people and a lot fewer people paying into the system, you're suddenly faced with the difficult choice of cutting people's benefits or massively increasing taxes. We're seeing that in the United States. Almost every European country is ahead of us. And they're all responding to it in very different ways, and they're all politically painful ways of trying to cut back benefits, raise taxes. Some are shifting to more investment-based individual account type systems and so forth, and that's precisely the kind of debate that we have to have in the U.S., and a lot of people very much are paying attention to that. Private pensions are, by and large, more funded, if not completely funded here. And tend to play a larger role than in a lot of those other countries. So that's an important distinction to make.
We just have about 5 minutes left. I want to make sure that we get a chance to talk a little bit about the state retirement system, since we sort of touched on that but didn't really go into it. It is something that has been of concern in recent years, and that the state, in particular the Illinois State University retirement system, has been rather underfunded and watching the drama play out in the state capital has been rather interesting over the last couple of years.
Yeah. The state university retirement system, as I said, there's this impairment clause in the state constitution that basically ties the legislature's and the governor's hands and says that the way to deal with any pension funding shortfall is not to touch benefits. You just can't do that. So they're pretty much required to come up with the money to fund these benefit promises. What happened back in the early 1980s is the legislature essentially decided to take what they call a pension funding holiday, which is shorthand for saying they didn't make the contributions they were required to. And had they done so back then, most calculations show that the system would roughly be fully funded today. Instead, we only have assets in the system that are somewhere in the 55 to 60% range. That may be a bit higher now that equity markets have been going back up. But we are underfunded to the tune of many billions of dollars. And so last year, I mean, obviously the state's in a tough fiscal crunch, and so the options weren't many. And so they resorted to what I frankly consider a little bit of a counting game, where they borrowed $10 billion by issuing some debt. And they said, well, we're going to let, you know, $2 to $2.5 billion of that 10 be our this year's contribution to the pension plans. But we're going to give them the whole $10 billion to invest, and then we're going to cross our fingers and hope that the investment returns on the $7.5 billion is enough to pay back the entire $10 billion in debt. That's obviously a very risky strategy. The people who bear the risk are the Illinois taxpayers. And, you know, it's a game that they were able to play because of the state budget rules. But I think it's important to recognize that from an economic standpoint, they weren't actually really doing much valuable there. It would be kind of akin to me going to the bank that holds my mortgage and say, hey, for every dollar that I owe you on this mortgage, I'm only going to pay you 70 cents of that. But if you guys invest that 70 cents well, you'll recoup the whole dollar that I owe you. You know, wouldn't you like to agree to that? But that's essentially the path that we're on, and things aren't looking a whole lot better for the coming year. The numbers are daunting. I mean, the contribution that the state needs to come up with in the coming year, I think, is on the order of $1.9 billion. And so naturally, they're going to look for ways to skimp on that if they can.
Now, this is something that has been a little bit confusing just to watch. This money that was borrowed to pay into the state university retirement system, presumably the state was paying that amount in previous years, was it not, from funds that were not borrowed?
Well, the annual contribution that the state was required to make last year was on the order of, you know, say, $2 to $2.5 billion. Mm-hmm. That's not just the CSRS, but all the public pension systems in the state. And they didn't have the $2 to $2.5 billion. And so what they went out and did is they borrowed $10 billion. Okay. And the idea was that they could then assume that the investment returns on the on that difference, that $7.5 billion extra money that they borrowed, they're hoping that the investment returns will be big enough to pay back the whole $10 billion plus interest. So it is a very confusing accounting transaction. It took me a while to sort of sort through and figure out exactly what was going on. But essentially, they're just hoping against hope that the returns on those investments will exceed the interest rate that they owe on that debt by several percentage points. And if that happens, you know, we'll have all gotten lucky and it will have worked out. If it doesn't happen, then the taxpayer is going to be back on the hook once again.
And you say that in view of this impairment clause in the Illinois Constitution, this essentially guarantees the beneficiaries that they will get their pensions.
Right. That's right. So they do have some flexibility going forward in terms of, you know, if they hired new employees, they could subject them to a different set of pension rules. Mm-hmm. But people like yourself and like me, who are currently employees of the university, the state constitution prohibits them from essentially changing the benefit formulas and so forth on us in a way that would reduce benefits. And that's that is a very tough predicament to be in. I mean, you've taken away one of the tools for balancing the system. It's certainly good for the employees. It just puts the risk on the taxpayer, and that's one of the things we have to grapple with at a time of an economic downturn.
Well, we'll have to leave it there since we're here at the end of our time. Our guest has been Jeffrey Brown. He's professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. We've sort of scratched the surface on this, but maybe we can talk about it again in the future.
Sure. Thanks. I enjoyed it.
Well, thanks for being here.
Thanks to the callers as well.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from around the world, featuring a selection of international European cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, and more. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University Avenue in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
That's it for this hour, Focus 580. In about 10 minutes, we'll be back talking with science writer Jake Page about his book, The Big One, The Earthquake That Rocked Early America and Helped Create a Science. First, we'll take a break for some news and a market update.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. Corn is lower this morning on a lack of exports as well as traders positioning in front of Monday's USDA supply and demand report. Also, traders are hearing reports of places like Nebraska where irrigation systems have not run yet this year. Let's go ahead and take a look at the current update for you. The July corn at 245.75, down 3.75. September, 249.5, down 4.25. December, 254.5, down 4. March, 262.25, down 3.75. July wheat, 334, down 7. September, 341.75, down 6.5. July soybeans, 652, down 9.5. August, 806.5, down 15. November, 650.